ADKT 501, in the matter of amendments to Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure Rule 3A and adoption of Nevada Rule of Appellate Procedure Rule 3F. Either Justice Hardesty, would you like to comment about that, please?
Yes, thank you, Chief. When I ran for the Supreme Court in 2004 and at various times after that, lawyers repeatedly asked for ways in which we could reduce the time for our consideration of appeals. There have been several ideas that were proposed, one of which became a part of our Rules of Appellate Procedure, which was to review venue cases on the pleadings that had been filed in the district court rather than having briefing before the court. At the time we considered that, my memory is that we had also talked about some of the areas that are embodied in the petition that was filed in this matter. Given the fact that this issue has come up again from a number of attorneys around the state, this petition was tendered to open the door for that conversation again. And I appreciate all of the input and comments and observations that we've received regarding issues surrounding summary judgment motions. There's a couple of other areas that relate to 12B5 dismissals or 12B dismissals that were also included in that. So the purpose behind the petition was to explore this question again and determine whether there are some adjustments that could be made to the NRAPs that would allow the court to enhance the disposition or speed up the disposition of cases that are referenced in the proposed rule.
If there are no other comments, can we have our first two speakers from Las Vegas?
Michael Lowry. George West is next. Is George still here? George, there you are. Come up, George, to the table up here.
Good afternoon. In the interest of getting us all out of here, I'll be quick. My name is Michael Lowry. I'm a partner with the Wilson Elser Las Vegas office, and we're in favor of the ADKT as proposed. The reasons we're in favor of it are already expressed in our written comments, and so I wanted to address some of the criticisms that I've seen in the written comments submitted. They fall into three general categories. The first is that there is concern that this proposal is revolutionary, that it is unprecedented within our rules, and Justice Hardesty just pointed out that it's not. We do consider them in venue options. We do consider them in criminal fast-track proceedings, in child custody proceedings. There's even, to a certain extent, thankfully I've not been part of one, but a bar disciplinary matters where the decision seems to be rendered frequently on the record submitted. This is not revolutionary, this is evolutionary. Apparently the court has seen benefits from these alternative procedures in other areas, and it seems to make sense to expand those to the civil realm. The other critique I see in general is that it decreases the chances for appellate advocacy. And as someone who does have or does handle his own appeals, yes, I agree. I'm one that would have perhaps fewer files to bill as a result of this rule. However, that's not the purpose of the rule. The rule is designed to, the purpose of the rules and this entire system is to reach a just, efficient, speedy determination straight out of Rule 1 from the civil procedure rules. The fact is that the advocacy that might be lost, that those in favor of, opposed to the ADKT do not want to see that advocacy, is now placed in the district court. It raises the importance of the briefing that is submitted to those district courts and hopefully raises the level of decision-making that occurs. There's also a concern that, finally, this would increase somehow the work upon the court and its staff. I disagree with that. The court and its staff are already going to view the appendix. You're already going to see what the district court did, what the district court was told. You are already going to see where all of the information is from its original source. Merely because a party puts a footnote or a citation in its brief does not mean that it is necessarily true or accepted by this court. Instead, what would happen is it increases the importance of the docketing statement. I feel like that piece of paper is so often overlooked or minimized, but it is the opportunity for those on appeal to identify the issues for the court so that the process can be streamlined. And I realize that we are short on time, so I will keep my comments short unless you have any questions.
Any, Chief, any questions from my colleagues?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. West?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice. May it please the court. My name is George West. I have been in practice for 26 years. My practice primarily involves consumer statutory litigation involving 41600, Chapter 598, other statutory protections. There are other consumer advocates here today in the chamber that also do straight statutory consumer cases. I don't think anybody in this room, and I think the entire bar, can say that everyone knows the very high demands and the caseloads of this court. I think before we had our Intermediate Court of Appeals put in, this court, from a caseload standpoint, was the busiest Supreme Court in the United States. And I would venture to say it's one of the top five at this point. And we're all very, very keen to the efficiencies that this court has to operate under every single day. That being said, as the court knows from the proposed rules, is that as I put in my comments, I think it's safe to say that 99.9% of every 12B5 motion, which is a terminating motion if it prevails, are brought by defendants. I would venture to say, based on my 26 years of experience, at least 95% of all summary judgments under Rule 56 are brought by the defense. And that is a standard practice, as I'm sure your honors are well aware, and they have that right to do that. I will also say, in my particular experience, I am not an appellate attorney, but I do my own appeals, and I do consult with other people. And I can say from also experience that when you're at the trial level on a summary judgment motion or 12B5, I can understand the court's viewpoint that many motions on summary judgment, Rule 56, are perfunctory in nature when you're dealing with issues of tribal issues of material fact. You're going to look at the separate statement, which is probably the most important document on summary judgment. But there are those significant portions of cases or other cases, a significant percentage, that have issues of first impression, nuanced issues that this court has never, ever looked at, especially with respect to statutory consumer law. And I think when you are looking at, well, actually I would say I would know based on my experience, when a summary judgment is granted, when a 12B6 is granted on an issue of law, those issues of first impression on issues of law, whether a claim for relief even exists, or that certain things may have been otherwise augmented or changed as a result of that statute with respect to common law, whatever that might be. I went into my Westlaw. I did a quick search. This court has rendered many issues of first impression based on grants of summary judgment, has issued new law based on 12B6 grants. And I don't believe those things can really be developed on the legal standpoint at the level that the nuanced issues come to this court at the appellate level. And even though the intent clearly is not to work against the plaintiff, this rule, the intent of this rule is efficiency, to speed up the appellate process. We all want that, but I don't think anybody wants it at the expense of expediency, given the terminating nature of the remedy as to both of these particular types of motions. And the operative effect of this rule is to have this rule, in effect, operate at a distinct disadvantage and to the prejudice of any plaintiffs who, as this court have ruled many times, that people should get a shot at their jury trial unless there is no tribal issue of material fact or if there is no claim for relief. And so I come out against this rule simply because of the effect it's going to have. I think appellate advocacy, where these nuanced issues of first impression that this court has ruled on from summary judgments, has led to new law on both sides. Because I think the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar and this court and our trial courts especially need guidance from this court. Many, many times we are dealing with tea leaves. Trial courts are always reading the tea leaves. And I think when we have good appellate advocacy on summary judgments, this court is able to get those new laws, issues of first impression, much more efficiently out to the bar and out to the trial courts through summary judgment grants than through an entire trial that comes back on an issue of a tribal issue of material fact. With that, I'd submit unless there's any questions.
Any questions?
Chief, any questions?
No questions. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if we can have one more, and then we'll take three from Carson.
The next person is Kelly Dove. Oh, excuse me, Paul Ray. I'm sorry. Paul. Kelly? Mr. Ray passes to Ms. Dove.
Thank you, Your Honors and Honorable Justices of the Court. And I, too, will keep my remarks brief. This is how you can keep everybody brief, right? By having a natural time barrier. I think as a practitioner primarily in appellate law, I don't primarily do my own appeals. I practice primarily in the area of appellate law, and I'm here both on behalf of the appellate litigation section and as a partner at Snell and Wilmer. I don't know if it's ever happened before, but while consensus is not dispositive here, the entire appellate litigation section who responded, every person who responded was opposed to this rule change for a number of reasons, several of which we laid out in our letter. I think some of them include the fact that there were concerns, just general concerns about due process and the appearance of what the court would be doing with a new process like this. Not that the court wouldn't necessarily be carefully considering appeals, but appeals could be viewed more as a rubber stamp in this kind of process and shift more of the balance of power to the district courts. Concerns that without the guarantee of briefing on appeal, that parties would feel the need to compensate for that lack of briefing in other ways, either by filing motions for reconsideration as a matter of course in the district court in an attempt to identify error where normal dispositive motion briefing is not geared toward error identification. Parties might try to compensate for lack of appellate briefing by increasing their filings of petitions for rehearing or rehearing en banc as a replacement briefing strategy. And I, in an effort to keep it short, I just also want to mention that I think the line that's drawn here in saying that these categories of appeals are perhaps not suitable for guaranteed briefing while other categories of appeals is maybe not drawn in the appropriate place. Lots of issues, as Mr. West alluded to, are complicated in summary judgment, complicated in motions to dismiss. Oftentimes they're important issues of law to be decided, and sometimes issues in other kinds of with other kinds of procedural background, issues that come out of a trial are important to those litigants, but maybe not as legally complicated, legally as important in deciding in on appeal. And I think if the court wants to consider some alternatives, I know this isn't the appropriate form for brainstorming alternatives, but I think there's other ways that you could consider changing maybe some of the mandatory briefing in ways that would address efficiency concerns without this particular rule change, which would get rid of briefing largely on appeals from dispositive motions. And perhaps the court could consider convening a committee, of which I know appellate litigation section members would be more than happy to participate in, to suggest some other alternatives or rule changes that might be tailored appropriately to consider some of the concerns that the court has or that the supporters of this rule have, but in a way that does that addresses also the concerns of those who oppose the rule change as it currently stands.
Any questions, Chief? Any colleagues?
We have no questions.
Thank you.
If we can have our first speaker, we'll take three from Carson City. We're in luck, Las Vegas.
Let's get a vote here. We've only got eight people in the room. How many are in favor of the ADKT as it is? We've got two, and then I'm assuming that six are against it. It's 2-6, Chief. That's all we have here.
Okay, do we have anyone with a dying ambition to...
Any burning desire? George Bojanis has a burning desire, and having known him all these years, it's our pleasure, George.
Thank you, Justice.
You voted against the ADKT.
I did, yes, thank you.
You're one of the six.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chief Justice. Justices George Bojanis, 631 South 9th Street, Las Vegas. I've had my own law practice here in Las Vegas since 1985. My reading of this proposed rule change is that no briefings allowed on appeals originating from grants of summary judgment and dismissal motions, and that these appeals now are going to be limited to an appendix of the motions relating to the summary judgment dismissal motions that typically consist of three pleadings, a motion, the opposition to the motion, and that reply to the motion. And this is where my concern rests with respect to this type of proposal. First, such a limitation and not allowing appellate briefing precludes analysis and argument on the most important part of this district court grant of a summary judgment or dismissal motion, that is the actual district court order. As a result of this proposed rule, there would be no briefing, there would be no argument on how the court eventually has decided that summary judgment or a dismissal motion is appropriate. The court is going to confine itself to those three pleadings in the grant of that motion and considering the appeal of such a decision. The second, and I think perhaps maybe more important or equally important concern I have, is that limiting a record of appeal to one party's motion reply and the other party's reply motion has a disproportionate impact on plaintiffs. I can tell you that I have probably 10 to 12 reported in Nevada Supreme Court appeals. I think all but one of them have to do with motions for summary judgment or motions for dismissal. Under this proposal, the entire record on appeal would have consisted of my one sole opposition to that motion. And that's where the concern arises with this type of a proposal. The bottom line on this is that when the court is considering the appeal of a case terminating order of dismissal or summary judgment, this court wants to have before it a record on appeal before that allows for thoughtful, thorough, and fair consideration of that district court order. Such a review by this court cannot occur by reviewing one brief provided by the party against whom that summary judgment or dismissal was granted. Further, such a review of such a limited record on appeal cannot also exist and cannot be thoroughly vetted by this court without a thorough review of the district court's order. So it's for these reasons that in the context of an attorney like myself whose practice is exclusively with civil tort litigation, that I have a lot of concerns with this proposed rule, and I appreciate your consideration with respect to these concerns, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Chief?
Any questions? There's no questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Janis. Mr. Ray?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. My name is Paul Ray. May it please the Court. I'll just simplify my remarks to the two main reasons why I personally oppose ADKT 501. One is the clients. I think they'll be extremely distressed to find out that they don't have a chance to review decisions by district court judges who were under tremendous caseloads themselves and may have missed points. And they'll be wondering, why do they not have an opportunity to brief that to this court and to the Court of Appeals? And my second reason is attorneys, and that is the appellate attorneys who practice before the court. I'm speaking for myself, but as the chair of the appellate litigation section, I have tremendous respect for these attorneys, and they were virtually unanimously very strongly opposed to this. And I think for many reasons that I attribute personally over the years, I've tried to go to different CLEs presented by various of your honors in different situations, Peeves and Peccadillos and prior justices. And one of the main things I got out of those CLEs was that, that the court does need the advocates who have spent the many hours, in some cases, normally hundreds of hours, sometimes thousands of hours, that the court simply doesn't have to spend on these cases. It would be, a strain and a severe burden on the justice process for the court to lose the benefit of the briefing of these attorneys. Thank you very much.
Any questions to Mr. Ray? Chief?
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. And I think that concludes the people who want to speak. Oh, wait, we have Steve Peake. Would be our final speaker. Mr. Peake, welcome.
Thank you. Stephen Peake, may it please the Court, Chief Justice, Justice Jerry. I don't have really a whole lot to add other than I think the most important part of consideration here is the case terminating part of this process that you now want to amend. These cases are all going to be terminated, as Paul pointed out, on one brief, or as Mr. Buchanan pointed out, on one brief. Because you only have the opportunity to oppose the motion to dismiss, and you have no opportunity to brief and point out the inconsistencies and the numerous errors that the district court made. It is up to now the Supreme Court, just on the briefs themselves, at the district court level, to determine whether or not there was error, as opposed to having the appellate advocate identify where he or she thinks those errors may have been committed by the lower court in your de novo review. So I think that's a denial, as others have said, of due process. I don't think it's going to expedite the process. I don't think it's going to shorten the life expectancy of a briefing schedule on 12b2, 12b5, and Rule 56 motion. So I oppose the rule. Steve Morris got me roped into making my opposition known, and he can't be here today, but he asked me at least to give his voice the same as mine in opposition.
I've heard of him.
Thank you. Well, you know, Steve is not one to be shy. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for being here in Las Vegas. Chief, that, I don't think anybody had any questions for Mr. Peake, but I think you're right. Any questions? No.
That being the case, we will close our public hearing. We will stand in recess till the call of the court at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.